This Valentine's Day, Dunkin's got the perfect pairings to show your love. So get down on one knee with a dozen brownie batter donuts and a cocoa mocha signature latte. Or make them swoon with a strawberry dragon fruit Dunkin' refresher with a Cupid's Choice donut. Are you ready for love? America runs on Dunkin'. Price and participation may vary. Limited time offer.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
It's Wednesday, December 7th, 2022. I'm Jackson Bird. Today, how less confusing food labeling and perhaps more food-based curriculum in schools can mitigate the huge problem of food waste. Plus, a new web-based simulator that will show you exactly how screwed you are if an asteroid hits your hometown. Here's some cool stuff for your ride home. Ahead of Thanksgiving this year, food waste nonprofit ReFed estimated that the U.S. would waste 305 million pounds of food after the big meal. Individual cost-wise, we're talking about $15 in food waste for each dinner for 10 people. Altogether, as a nation, that's about $450 million. Or enough food to make about 6.5 meals per person for the 38.3 million food insecure people in the country. And on an individual scale, going beyond Thanksgiving, we're talking about $1,300 a year in wasted food. As Harvard Law professor and founding director of its Food, Law, and Policy Clinic, Emily Broadlieb, told NPR's All Things Considered earlier this year, the amount of food an average household wastes per week is basically the equivalent of going to the store, buying 3 bags of groceries, and then immediately putting one of those bags in the trash. And it's not just the impact this is having on our inflation-tightened budgets or the impact it could be having on helping out the food insecure among us. It's also having a huge impact on the climate. A recent piece on food waste in The Atlantic by Yasmin Tayog pointed out that the annual emissions of rotting food in the U.S. is equivalent to about 42 coal-fired power plants. ReFed adds that emissions from our Thanksgiving dinner food waste alone is equivalent to driving 169,000 cars for one full year. And one of the biggest culprits behind food waste? Uncertainty around the meaning of expiration date labels on food. A study Broadlieb co-authored in 2019 found that 84% of consumers report always or usually throwing food away based on the date on the label. Now, there's certainly a lot that we could be doing in terms of better meal planning and getting more creative with using our food before that date rolls around, but the dates themselves on the labels can be misleading. They're not the same across the board, for starters. You might see best before, or sell by, or best if used by. And most of those refer to when the quality of the food will begin to diminish. And food manufacturers are upfront about this. They want the consumer to enjoy their food when it's in its best state. But a lot of people interpret those labels as the food being unsafe after that date. When it comes to food safety, experts say they're concerned about foodborne illnesses that would send you to the hospital, things like E. coli, salmonella, and listeria. We don't have labels for those, though. Pathogens like those are usually a result of contamination, improper storage, not cooking to hot enough temperatures, unsanitized utensils or work surfaces, stuff that happens after purchase, so you can't really make a label for it. Listeria, on the other hand, as The Atlantic points out, is a bit easier to suss out. It can pop up in deli meats, raw fish, sprouted vegetables, and unpasteurized milk and cheese, and therefore most of the food experts who work on labeling and food safety are in support of adding extra caution labels to foods like those. But here's another problem with labels as they currently stand in the U.S. There is not actually a federal requirement around labeling dates on food, for the most part. It currently varies state to state, and it varies widely. Here in New York, labels technically aren't required. In Montana, milk has to be sold within 12 days of pasteurization, but in Idaho, it's a full 11 days later. If we're supposed to believe one of those numbers is correct in determining when pasteurized milk is still safe to consume by, that is a pretty huge gap. But Brodlieb explained in The Atlantic that pasteurized milk is actually one of the safest foods on the market. The pasteurization kills the germs, so even if it's soured or curdled, it's actually still pretty safe. Some recipes even call for it that way. Other foods that might look bad but are still perfectly safe? If it's been refrigerated and is headed for the oven, don't sweat it. As long as it gets up to the correct temperature, about 160 degrees Fahrenheit for most meats, but always Google it to double check, the heat will kill off any germs that you might need to worry about. And as for dry goods, Brodlieb said, quote, "You're not taking your life into your hands if you're eating a stale cracker or cereal," end quote. Aside from listeria and some of those cold, ready-to-eat foods like deli meats and raw fish, which are of larger concern during pregnancy, the only product that is unsafe after its expiration date, and which is therefore the only one the federal government does have a requirement around, is infant formula. That one you do need to pay attention to. But all these different things to know. I mean, sure, we have Google now so we can look it up, and The Atlantic recommended an excellent book by a scientist from the Natural Resources Defense Council called Waste-Free Kitchen Handbook, which includes a whole directory of how to use food that's gone past its best-by date or even developed a little bit of mold. It sounds like an amazing resource to have in the kitchen, maybe even a good holiday gift. But the fact that we have to Google all of this or find resource books, that so many people don't even know the true meaning of Best Buy labels, and that even though we as a species literally developed disgust so that we would know to avoid pathogen-tainted food, yet some of us still doubt our instincts when it comes to that, how did we get here? How did people survive in their own kitchens before Google? As Sarah Gonzalez at NPR's All Things Considered summarized it, quote, "Before World War II, before everyone got a refrigerator, people got most of their food from farms, and they'd just look at it, smell it, taste it, and know if it went bad. But when we start getting more and more processed food, and we start getting most of our food from grocery stores instead of farms, that's when we start wanting to know, like, how long is this orange juice good for? By the 1970s, 95% of consumers think dates on food are the most useful thing. And then state lawmakers started to introduce food date laws based on some experience they had," end quote. As a representative from ReFed told The Atlantic, quote, "We are now several generations removed from agriculture and food production, so we don't know our food as well as they once did," end quote. Unless you grew up on or have worked at farms, or maybe if you've been to culinary school, we're just not as in touch with these basic concepts as we used to be. So here are two things experts are proposing. First, progress is being made in both the U.S. House and Senate for federal label regulations. These would replace all labels with a standard set of two: best if used by and use by. So the first will tell you when it's of optimal quality, making for happy manufacturers and foodies alike, and the second telling you when it's no longer safe to eat. The other initiative that will likely take a long time to gain ground, but would have many benefits far beyond simply the idea of being more familiar with what unsafe food smells and looks like, is the reintroduction of home economics classes in schools. Surprisingly, The Atlantic says that every single expert they talked to recommended this, albeit, as The Atlantic says, quote, "with different branding and no sexism," end quote. I've had this thought a lot over the years, too. There's so much it seems like previous generations learned about how to do things around the house, stuff that younger generations either never learn at all or learn in a more piecemeal fashion via online tutorials whenever challenges come up. Which is fine, but I don't think a more comprehensive curriculum would go amiss. Plus, I think almost every American would tell you they would welcome the economics portion of that home economics class if it truly existed. How we can go through 12-plus years of schooling and never get taught anything about personal finance, topics like balancing a budget, the risks of taking out loans, how to invest in retirement, and on, is truly mind-boggling. And I'll be the first one to argue for the merit of simply learning how to think and learning self-discipline as valid reasons for high schoolers spending ample time on topics like microbiology and calculus and early modern European history, topics many of them will never need again in their lives. But surely students can get some similar academic outcomes from also learning about topics and skills that will benefit them in their day-to-day adult lives, like how to avoid predatory loans and how to identify cheese that has gone bad or how to prevent it from going bad in the first place. Because remember those numbers up top? 305 million pounds of food waste from Thanksgiving alone. $1,300 lost in household budgets annually from food waste. 42 coal-fired power plants worth of emissions from food waste. It's one of an endless list of things that we could be doing for the climate crisis. It might sound kind of silly, but teaching kids more about food handling while they're growing up could have big effects on our environment years down the line. For now, though, we will keep using Google and maybe trying to eat more of the food that we buy, even if the label says that it was best a week and a half ago.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
One of my favorite developers of fun and interesting data-based web experiences, Neil Agarwal, launched another doozy over the weekend. Agarwal has previously made interactive experiences like a 3D visualization of the size of objects in space, as well as one that takes you to the depths of the ocean, and another one with running tallies of how many things happen per second, like Big Macs sold, internet searches made, and skin cells shed. Over the weekend, he debuted his Asteroid Launcher. It's a cleanly designed and well-researched simulator that allows you to pick an impact location, a size, speed, impact angle, and material of an asteroid, and then see its effects. The asteroid size options top out at 1 mile in diameter, so I wasn't able to simulate the asteroid that killed the dinosaurs, which was about a little more than 6 miles in diameter, but I did see what would happen if a 1 mile wide carbon asteroid hit Central Park at 38,000 miles per hour at an angle of 45 degrees. And wow, even knowing it would be bad, I was still kind of stunned by the results. According to the ample details available on the simulator, such an impact would create a 7.5-mile-wide crater, which would immediately vaporize 1.5 million people, as it generates the equivalent of 43 gigatons of TNT and releases more energy than the entire world consumes in a year. There would also be a 14-mile-wide fireball that would cause second-degree burns as far as Scranton, Pennsylvania, and Springfield, Massachusetts. The 246-decibel shockwave would cause homes to collapse within a similar perimeter, not to mention kill over 5 million people in the tri-state area. An 11,296-mile-per-hour wind speed would lead to the demise of an additional 3 million, as all trees in a 136-mile radius would be knocked down. Adding to that would be a 7.6-magnitude earthquake that would be felt from 200 miles away. Jeez! There are even more details beyond that which the simulator lists alongside visual data from Apple Maps. Speaking to Vice, Agarwal said one reason he wanted to build the simulator was to help people truly visualize the effects of major natural disasters. He said, quote, "Asteroids are a good choice since their effects are so far-reaching. I think the tool could also help people gain more appreciation for our need to deflect asteroids like in NASA's DART mission." End quote. Futurism was thinking similarly, saying the tool could help generate public support for NASA and their future asteroid-deflecting missions like DART. On the research that went into the asteroid launcher, quoting Vice, A lot of math went into this project. The simulation is based on papers by Dr. Gareth Collins and Dr. Clemens Rumpf, the simulator's about page said. Collins is a professor at the Imperial College of London who studies impacts, and Clemens Rumpf is a former NASA engineer who's published multiple papers on asteroid impacts and their effect on humanity. On Twitter, Agarwal said he thought building asteroid launcher would only take a month, but the physics were complicated. In the end, Agarwal said the whole thing took about 2 months to build, with the first month dedicated to research. And Agarwal said the most difficult part was learning the asteroid physics. Asteroid impact simulation is a whole area of research, and it can get pretty complicated, with supercomputers needed to get the most accurate results, he said. End quote. Jason Kottke also discovered this latest Agarwal drop yesterday and had the same thought as me. To compare it to the dinosaur-killing asteroid, he pulled out a contextual excerpt from Peter Brannan's book The Ends of the World. Quote, "The meteorite itself was so massive that it didn't notice any atmosphere whatsoever. It was traveling 20 to 40 kilometers per second, 10 kilometers, probably 14 kilometers wide, pushing the atmosphere and building such incredible pressure that the ocean in front of it just went away." End quote. So, I mean, I guess that's part of why Agarwal's upper limit on the asteroid diameter for the asteroid launcher is less than a sixth the size of the one that killed the dinosaurs, because how would you even begin to visualize the ocean just going away? In any case, this is an absolutely horrifying, yet oddly fun and certainly captivating game that I definitely recommend messing around with. Speaking of asteroids, Wes Anderson's next film, Asteroid City, just announced its theatrical release date of June 2023. Written alongside Roman Coppola, the film has an even larger than usual for Wes Anderson cast, with many of the usual suspects as well as some fresh faces. The lineup includes Jason Schwartzman, Adrian Brody, Tilda Swinton, Tony Revolori, Bryan Cranston, Ed Norton, Liev Schreiber, Maya Hawke, Sophia Lillis, Scarlett Johansson, Margot Robbie, Steve Carell, Tom Hanks, Jeff Goldblum, Willem Dafoe, and more. The movie takes place in a fictional desert town in 1955 at a junior stargazer and space cadet convention, during which the plans of the students and parents in attendance are, quote, "spectacularly disrupted by world-changing events," end quote. As a huge space race nut, color me intrigued. And speaking of Wes Anderson, and space, sort of, earlier this week, the Russo brothers posted some AI art generated by fan Adam Hall that imagines their Avengers films as directed by Wes Anderson. The AI-generated images feature muted colors, giant sideburns on Cap, mid-century renderings of Iron Man and Ant-Man, lots of brown office settings. It's pretty great, and the Russo brothers seemed to be big fans as well, captioning their Instagram post, "Where can we watch this?" Link is in the show notes to check it out for yourself if you're interested. But that is it from me for today. This show was produced by Ride Home Media. I'm Jackson Bird, and I'll talk to you again tomorrow.